So hi, Jenny. It's nice to see you today. I'm excited to get to talk to you. My name is Lizzie Briskin, and I just want to give a brief introduction to Jenny, who is with me today. She's a food writer and New York Times bestselling cookbook author. Her blog, Dinner a Love Story, has been a resource for recipes, food, and family-related musings and smart recommendations for over a decade. Jenny's work has been featured by NPR, The New York Times, New York Magazine, Real Simple, and Bon Appetit, where she was a columnist for 7 years. She's a food writer for the women's lifestyle website Cup of Joe and has written 4 cookbooks, Dinner, A Love Story, Dinner, The Playbook, How to Celebrate Everything, and her newest book, Weekday Vegetarians, which details Jenny's family's transition from a mostly meat-centered to a plant-based lifestyle at least 5 days a week. And that is what we are going to talk about today.
Yay. Thanks for having me, Lizzie.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so let's just get into it. In the book, you write pretty candidly about being a family accustomed to eating meat, mostly as the center of your plate. And you decided to move away from that towards more of a plant-based eating style. So can you talk a little bit about what initiated that transition and how it went at the beginning?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's no joke to say that we ate meat probably like 5 out of 7 nights a week before I started this undertaking a couple years ago. We just grew up with like the idea of the way you think about dinner or the way you picture dinner is like you put a piece of chicken in the middle and then you surround it with something else. And our parents ate like that, their parents ate like that. And so that's how I wrote about food for a while. And obviously the conversation about climate change was getting a little bit too loud to ignore after a certain point. And I just felt like the day we decided to start this project, which is to eat meat only on the weekends or to just sort of dial back as much as we could. We just decided that we knew that by dialing back on meat, that was the single most impactful way that we could make a difference in a world where like it just sometimes feels like you're so helpless to change anything when you read the headlines. And so I just sort of decided the conversation had been already getting, you know, it was already very loud by the time we decided to do this, but luckily so many chefs and cookbook authors and food reporters were ahead of me on this. And so it just felt like every day a new cookbook or a new magazine story or an Instagram account or something was showing us how easy it was to be plant-based. And so it felt like when I decided to do it, I thought, you know what, there's gonna be a lot of resources right now and it's probably not gonna be as hard as I think it's going to be. I was wrong, but I have 2 young kids. I had 2 young kids at the time. Actually, they're not young anymore. They're in college, but at the time they were 14 and 16. And, you know, they were game for it, but it was hard because, as I said, like we just grew up with certain kinds of dinners. And added to that, I wrote about these dinners in a way that connected us and connected us to our families. And so there's a lot of like sentimental attachment around them. And so it was hard to just say, okay, we're not having great Grandma Toronto's meatballs anymore. You know, we knew we couldn't do that, but we just felt like, you know what, we can maybe just save our meatballs and our pork chops and, you know, Grandma Jody's chicken for the weekend. And so that's where we started. And it was a good place to start. So.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then how far along the journey do you realize that you might want to do a cookbook related to it?
Well, honestly, this was the first cookbook I've written where I was writing about it in real time, whereas all the other cookbooks I wrote, I knew exactly what I wanted to say. I had a rotation and a repertoire of meals and recipes that I just had to package up and, you know, write the story around. But this one, I honestly, when I pitched the book, I pitched it as sort of a challenge to myself and to my family, because I thought, well, if I have this book as a deadline, it's going to hold me accountable to actually doing this. Like, I can't cheat that much, you know, because, and it just so happened that it fell during the pandemic, like most of the recipe developing and the research and the writing. So it was it was really, really fun. You know, I was inside cooking all day, and we were all inside cooking all day anyway. So it made it easier. But I honestly, when I pitched it before that, I wasn't sure I would be able to do it. Like, I didn't really, it's one thing in theory to say you want to do it. It's another thing entirely to have to produce plant-based meals night after night when you're not used to cooking that way. So I had to really rearrange my, the way I thought about dinner and cooking.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure it was a pretty big adjustment. Was, who in your family was the hardest to convince?
You know, I don't think there's actually an answer to that. I thought it would be my husband, who's also an Amherst graduate, Andy Ward, class of 94. But he was, just because he was like the guy who like, he was just, you know, he liked nothing more than just like grilling a steak in the summer with like a gin and tonic, or, you know, just like making a big braised pork shoulder on the weekend. Like, he just like, I don't want to be like too stereotypical here, but he just loved, like, most of the meals that he loved the most were meat-based. And so when I said to him, we need to stop eating so much meat, I was expecting a little pushback on that and just him to be like, you know, oh yeah, let me know how that goes. But he was ready too. Like, it just turned out, you know, we're at a certain age where we're like also thinking way more about our health, and, you know, our parents are aging and we're looking at the way they take care of themselves, and it's informing the way we take care of ourselves. And so we were kind of all ready. We were ready. And my kids were learning about climate change in school, and they were totally willing in theory to do it. I think they resisted. I don't think they realized it was going to be as hard as it was, because they really needed to be on board with a lot of foods that they weren't used to eating as a matter of course, like tofu. They're still not like completely into tofu, but, you know, beans, obviously they could tolerate them, but they weren't, it wasn't the kind of thing that they would get excited about the way they would get excited about, you know, like a burger or whatever. And then neither of my kids really eat eggs, so that was tricky. Anyway, we were all toddlers again, and we just had to like keep trying and keep exposing. And then eventually it just became the norm to just like think, okay, what's for dinner? Let's think plant-based first. And then if we can't come up with something, or if we really are craving meat, then we'll do that. But for the most part, our fallback plan is we've just gotten ourselves so into this rhythm now that it's easy.
Right. And you mentioned, I think you said you were dropping one of your daughters off at college yesterday. Are they, now that they're out on their own, like going for the plant-based options at the dining hall?
That's a good question. You would think I would have asked them that, and I haven't, but, probably. I mean, I think, that's a really good question. I think for the most part, all I know is that when they come home, they're both so excited to have home cooked meals. And most of those meals have been vegetarian. So I get a lot of pictures from the dining hall of, pastas and cacio e pepe and things like that, you know, so, you know, that counts as vegetarian, but I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question. I'm going to go grill them as soon as this is over.
Great. One of the things that I love that you talk about throughout the book is this idea of developing a recipe, or when you think about a meal, you always want to have some sort of hook. And it's, you know, a phrase common in writing as well. And if you could just talk a little bit about what a hook is and how you think about it. Let's take tofu as an example, because I know your daughters aren't the only people who are a little bit skeptical when it comes to tofu. So if you were to think of a hook for tofu, which I know you have done, how would you go about that?
Well, first, to explain the idea of the hook, I mean, not that it needs, it's pretty self-explanatory, but the way it came about was, I had been listening to a podcast, a food writer talk about tofu, and it was Melissa Clark, and she was talking about shredding it on the side of a grater. And then like it behaves, once you do that, and if it's shredded, it behaves like ground meat. And so I thought, that sounds like something that might, if I like add enough spices and stuff to it, maybe that's a way that I can convince my kids to like it. I was just kind of looking at every technique of how to prepare tofu. And I must not have listened to her directions very well, because it ended up just being such a dis- disastrous meal. Like it was just mushy and flavorless. And I just like ended up not having the right vegetables. So I used like frozen, but it was just like all terrible. And my daughter, both my daughters love to eat. One of them though was like, "Mom, this is like a terrible dinner. I don't know what you did." Like, and she, they're very great, you know, like gracious, grateful eaters usually. And she said, "You know what was missing here? It's like, there's nothing on my plate that I like, that was like, that was calling to me. Like I wasn't excited about anything in this entire meal." And I was like, "Oh, so you need like a hook. You need to latch yourself onto one thing on the plate that's like exciting." And that's sort of where that idea came from. And she's like, "Yeah, like even if it's just a salad dressing, like on a boring salad or a peanut sauce you know, sometimes it's just like a piece of like a really good yogurt flatbread, you know, like for if I'm trying to get them to eat lentils or whatever, I made like a fresh, like, you know, 20 minute flatbread that it's just like will make anything taste good." So that's a hook. But for tofu, what we ended up using, there's a recipe for pan-seared tofu in here with the spicy peanut sauce. And the peanut sauce is like one of those things that, you know, you can put that on anything in our house and they'll eat it. Same thing with like it's sort of a teriyaki-ish sauce. But like if you dredge tofu and pan fry it and it's crispy outside and then tender inside, and you drizzle a glaze on it, like a chili glaze or that teriyaki-ish type glaze that's in the book, that's going to be a hook. And that's always going to get them to eat it a little bit more easily. You know, it also convinced me and my husband too. It's not just them. So that was like, that's a big section in my book, and just like how to just have, these kinds of things lying around, or just like making a good homemade Caesar dressing, cause that's a hook, or making like a cornbread for the chili. Cause the cornbread, if it's fresh and it's as easy to make as like, you know, like the batter's as easy as pancake batter to make. And if you just have that next to a three bean chili, it's just more likely to get someone excited about the chili. And so that's how I started thinking about it. And I also, since I write so much for parents with young kids, like I just thought that that would be a helpful section for them. I use it all the time. I mean, those are like sauces, dressings, breads. I think that's glazes, like all of those things are legitimate hooks, and they've worked in my house for this past few, during the period that I was starting and researching and launching the whole project.
Yeah, it's so smart, and it totally makes sense. And another theme that you have throughout the book is you often will include, non-meat or ways to add animal proteins to meals in the case where you're maybe cooking for multiple different eating styles in one household. If you could share some of your tips for getting those more vegetarian skeptics on board, in addition to the hook, which is obviously a great one, but how to manage if there are different eating styles, or just to encourage the meat lover.
I also felt like it was not realistic to assume that everyone was going to be on board with everything that I was making every night. And so there's always a tip on every recipe that's called for the holdout, for like the one person who's like, "I'm not going to eat this chili. It's all beans and no meat." So like for that person, you know, there's like a little instruction, you know, just pan fry some ground turkey or ground beef in, you know, on the side, and add that at the last minute. Because what happens is like, if you end up catering to the meat eater, then all of you at the table end up not eating vegetarian. And like the whole point of this book and this idea and is just to get like as many people as possible eating less meat, right? So like if it's three people in your house who are eating less meat on a given night, that's great. If it's all four of you, even better. But like realistically, I think to get people on board with this, you have to kind of acknowledge that there's going to be holdouts, and you have to be flexible about it. So that was one way to do it. Like there's a banh mi in here, a tofu banh mi that's like, it's inspired by an Andrea Nguyen recipe. And it's like for the longest time, one of my daughters just was like, I'm not eating that. It's so good. It's like a pan seared tofu with like pickled vegetables and a spicy mayo and like a really good bread. But like, so I would just marinate her like chicken on the side, like just a chicken breast, like pounded really thin. And so like she would have that. It was easy enough to just like throw that in, and then the rest of us would have the tofu. And then eventually she got, it, you know, it's like the toddlers again, like eventually once you're exposed to it enough, you're like, all right, I'll have the tofu. So now I don't have to do that anymore. But anyway, there throughout the book, there's all sorts of suggestions for how to kind of cater to that lowest common denominator at the table.
Yeah, I think that flexibility is so important. Just people in general, I found, don't like being pigeonholed into one strict way of eating, especially if it's not their natural inclination. So I think that's really important. And yeah, I definitely like how you keep things flexible on the weekends. Have you found that your weekend eating style has also leaned more vegetarian, or do you like go wild with the burgers on Friday night?
I know, everyone's always like, because we did this for a while with like drinking too. Like we were just like cutting back on, like we'd have a glass of wine every day. And then we just like in the last like 10 or like 8 years or so, we've like cut back on that. And so everyone's always joking that like our house on the weekends must be just like, we just like go crazy, but it's actually not true. What happens is with the vegetarian thing, it's not like any, in the beginning, it was absolutely Monday through Friday, no meat. And then on the weekends, meat. But then like, it just ends up seeping into your everyday choices, you know? And like, even if I was out on a Saturday and I would just like immediately kind of go first, I would look at the vegetarian stuff first. And then like on the weekends, I mean, during the week, sometimes I would, you know, there would be like, I don't know, someone would just want chicken in their salad and I would do like, so it becomes, it's not like as strict a policy anymore in terms of like the day of the week, but I would say overall it evens out to just like, in general, we're eating plant-based way more than we're eating meat. So it's just like it's a legitimate lifestyle, I would say, just like the way we approach cooking and ordering food.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And when you are just cooking, either, I guess, developing a recipe for the book, for your blog, or just kind of riffing on like a weeknight, are there any places that you look for inspiration or cookbooks or creators that you often reach for in terms of developing recipes?
Yeah, I mean, all the time. It's kind of a mysterious process how it works, but yeah, there were, when I was working on the book and developing recipes, I was really like leaning heavily on a few books for just like learning how to make vegetables exciting. Like Ottolenghi is obviously really good at that. You know, and then Alice Waters has a book called Chez Panisse Vegetables. That's really great. Bryant Terry has a book. He's vegan. He's a book called Vegetable Kingdom that I liked. Nigel Slater, who's a British writer. He has this unbelievable series called, what is it called? It's so unbelievable. I can't remember the name. I think Green Feast, but they're like, it's basically like, you've seen them like packaged. They're like gift books. And they're just, it's just the way he cooks from his garden. It's so simple and beautiful. And each recipe is called like, you know, squash, sage, cream. Like it's so beautifully photographed too. And so far there have been two books. There's been one that's autumn and winter, and there's one that's spring and summer. And I hope that they're going to kind of continue it. I don't know. I don't know where else it would go besides those seasons. But I just find so much, he just inspires me so much. So especially when I was writing this book. So yeah.
Yeah, I've seen those. They are stunning. And yeah, very smartly put together.
Yes.
What are some pantry staples that you, like, now that you're cooking vegetarian primarily, always have on hand and that you would recommend to other vegetarian newbies?
I mean, I always have chickpeas now. I always have good beans. I feel like I've probably, at this point, I should be like partnering with Rancho Gordo in Napa, because in every single interview, I think I talk about this. But once I discovered their beans, or they have heirloom beans, they're out of Napa, and they're so superior to just like the everyday canned beans, or even just like dried beans where you like get them at the supermarket and you're not sure like how old they are. And the recipe on the cover of the book is it's a brothy bean recipe. It has like, I knew I wanted it to be on the cover because I couldn't believe that beans could look that good. Like I would have never believed that. And it just is like, once what basically the recipe is, it's also just like all encompassing in terms of like just what it represents for like the kind of cooking I would like to do. And what I'm hoping people will get out of this book is like how easy it can be to cook vegetarian, and not like, just, it doesn't have to be super overwhelming. And like this recipe is like, I just basically take a bag of Rancho Gordo lima beans in the morning, and I just like put, I soak them all day in like a big Dutch oven, just with covered by water for like 2 inches. And then I don't really touch them all day. I don't even drain the water. I know like some people say you have to drain them, but I don't even do that. I like, you know, an hour before I want to eat dinner, I just put an onion in there, salt, pepper, bay leaf, whatever herbs I have, like thyme or rosemary or parsley. Usually it's thyme. And then a ton of olive oil. And then I just simmer them for an hour. And then the broth cooks down a little bit, and it gets, you wouldn't like, just those really basic ingredients, you wouldn't think it would taste good. But what I do is I serve that with, you can top it with burrata, or like a store-bought pesto, and serve it with crusty bread. And that's, I mean, I could eat that every night. It's so good. And if you're vegan, there's options for, like you can top it with romesco, which is just like a, you can get a store-bought one, but it's also very easy to make. There's a recipe in my book for one that uses like roasted sweet, jarred sweet red peppers. And you just swirl that with, in a food processor with almonds and garlic and olive oil. And that's like delicious dolloped on top of the beans. That recipe was like, it made me realize how much, it's like the fundamental rule of cooking. You start with really good ingredients, and those beans were like a life changer. But also in my pantry, chickpeas, we have like crispy chickpeas have basically replaced chicken in our lives. Like where we used to just like, I walk in the door and like, you know, like cube up a chicken breast and serve that in a taco or in a salad or whatever, or like a rice bowl. Then now I just do that with chickpeas, and you can just add the cayenne smoked paprika and garlic powder, onion powder, with oil, let them just sizzle for 15 minutes, and they're so good and tasty and work really well in like Caesar salads or bowls or tacos. And so those, and then smoked paprika, that's a good thing to just have around, because I feel like with meat, like you're always looking for some, you're missing some depth. And so things like smoked paprika, nutritional yeast is another one, like that just add that like little hint of something extra going on that that I tend to miss when the meat's not there. And same with mushroom powder, you can get that at most like better supermarkets, but you can also order it on Amazon, like a porcini powder. It's expensive, but like just a little of it in a stir fry just adds so much depth to it that it really makes a difference. So yeah, those are a few things that I've just discovered. I've been using a lot more than I used to.
Yeah. Yeah. I love all of those tips. I'm a huge nutritional yeast fan. I just feel like it really needs a rebrand because it just doesn't sound like something that you want. I agree.
What do you use it for? Just everything?
Yeah. I mean, I love putting it on like Caesar salads, anything pasta, anything like cheese. It's a great cheese replacement. And I eat cheese. Like I'll use it with cheese. It's good.
Yeah. I like it. Well, because like what happens is when I was developing these recipes, so many people were like, please don't be the vegetarian book that just like makes you eat pasta and cheesy carbs every night, like, because that's so easy. And I saw how like easy it was to fall into that trap. And when I was writing these recipes, I was like determined not to do that. And I think I succeeded. I mean, there are a few of those recipes in here, but out of 100, maybe there's like 7 or 8 of those. But I found like nutritional yeast was so helpful for like anytime I wanted to just like like there's a mushroom galette in here. And instead of doing like Gruyere on it, which is like what you would want kind of underneath a pile of mushrooms and leeks, I pressed in the nutritional yeast to the dough before wrapping it in the galette. And so it doesn't necessarily mean it's dairy-free because the crust is obviously not dairy-free, but at least it's just like a little bit less cheese than you would be used to having. And it's so good. Like it's just really big. I don't know why. It's magic.
It's like umami, just pure umami.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I use it in my Caesar dressing for the vegan version of the Caesar dressing, anywhere you use Parmesan basically. And people, I know a lot of people use it on popcorn. I don't do that, but it sounds like that would be delicious too. So
yeah, my only problem with that would be, I feel like it would just fall right off the pop. You need something to get it to stick, but
probably do.
I definitely appreciate how ingredient focused the book is. And I'm curious just to get your thoughts. What do you think about these plant-based vegan and vegetarian alternatives to like meat and dairy and yogurt, all these different options on the shelves now? Do you use them?
I'll start with the meat alternatives, which I was like very excited about when they were all like starting to pop up. Because it was kind of at this time that I was starting this project. So we went like a little crazy. And I actually, for one of first, I had to do a story for the website, like a taste test of all the plant burger alternatives. And it just so happened that it was like scheduled to run on, or I was scheduled to do the tasting with like a photographer and with like this woman who is a vegetable butcher. Her name's Karen Nicoletti. Anyway, I was doing all the shopping for this story and it was like March 11th, 2020, you know? And so like it got canceled at the last minute because of COVID. And that was like the week the world shut down. And so I had a freezer filled with all of this, all of these burgers. And so like over the course of 2 or 3 months, like I tried all of them. And I will say that I like Impossible Burger the best. Beyond is like the one that's I would usually like the second most popular, but Impossible tastes the most like meat. But like the thing is, after a certain point, maybe it's just because I had so many of them, but like I kind of was like, I'm over this like very quickly. And that it kind of inspired me to develop a real veggie burger. And I did, and I've never really had a veggie burger that I like, but I was determined to find it. There's one in this book. It's different from the rest of the recipes because it actually requires a little fussiness, and you have to, I recommend preparing them on the weekend and then just stashing the patties in the freezer so that you can, then they become a 10 minute dinner. But it involves like all veggie burgers involve like 1,000 things in them. This is no different. There's a lot of stuff happening, but I was really proud of it. And it's my kids love them. They make them for themselves, which is nice. They just like pull one out. If we can't be home for dinner, it's a really easy, healthy meal for them. I also just want to say about like the whole reason why those products are on the market, or at least I know I read an interview with the Impossible founder, like they're meant to appeal to meat eaters, not to vegetarians. And I love that concept, stuck with me like when I was writing this book, because that's what I wanted. Obviously like vegetarians, I would love them to love this book, but I really like the whole mission of this book was to get more people eating less meat versus fewer people eating no meat. You know what I mean? So it was really that whole like mission behind Impossible, I found really helpful. And so when I was conceptualizing recipes, I did kind of think about like, well, what is the meat eater going to miss here? Versus like, what is the vegetarian who's already used to this going to appreciate, you know? So that's a long answer to that question. The second part of your question, like the yogurt alternatives and all that, we had a brief period where one of my kids was went gluten-free and dairy-free. So I experimented a lot with them and I loved it. I really thought there were some amazing products on the market. Like the, I'm going to pronounce it wrong. Miyoko's, I think. How I'm saying it? Her butter and her yogurt and her cream cheese, like I'm astounded that those are vegan. They're such good products. I use those a lot. Again, nutritional yeast, I used a lot for that when I was going through that phase. But yeah, I found that really fun. I found it really fun to experiment with those products. It's so nice that we have all those options now if you have restrictions.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with that. And I also like trying them out. It's always fun. Yeah. And you mentioned that the cover photo of your book. And I'm just like, the photos are of any cookbook are just so essential to people eat with their eyes first. So if you could talk a little bit about how you wanted the aesthetic of your book to come, and if you worked with a photographer, and how that process went.
Yeah. I mean, the photographer is Christine Hahn, who I've worked with before, on a lot of just different stories, magazine stories and website stories. She's wonderful. And I was really, after all of my books, I've wanted to, I don't want them to be intimidating ever. Like the whole purpose of this is that I'm not a chef, I'm a home cook, and I want people to just not be intimidated by the process of dinner. So there's not a lot of heavy styling, meaning like there's not a lot of, nothing looks perfect. And so that's always been kind of the guiding principle of the photography in all my books, but especially in this one. And then I actually had a food stylist help with this too, which sounds funny, but like it's so much work to shoot a cookbook, and it was just made it so much easier to have someone like cooking food, and then I would be just sort of like making sure that it looked the way that it was supposed to look. And Olivia McCool was the one who did the food styling, and she's like a magician. She spends her time like, you know, like making sure the glaze is perfect on Dunkin' Donuts and stuff. So it was really, and we filmed that during the pandemic too, so that was like a challenge. That was definitely a challenge, but it was, I mean, if you look at the pictures, like there's a lot of like pizzas on parchment paper and, just things that look like they just came out of the oven. Like nothing is plated in a really like traditional way. And almost all of the plates and glasses and utensils are my own. I wanted it to feel like not super slick. I wanted it to feel like just like someone pulling up to my dinner table. And I mean, sometimes that's impossible, but yeah, as you said, like it was imperative that the photos look good because people eat with their eyes first, and it was already a tough sell. So like if you, some of the names of these recipes, like I'm just imagining them without pictures and it would have been a fail. So I was thrilled with the way they came out.
Yeah, I mean, all the photos are so enticing, and I would definitely say you hit the perfect note of feeling homey, but also just nicely composed and kind of cozy, and just a bright aesthetic that's very nice.
I also felt like the first few books, like, were so much, since I was like blogging more at the time, and it was more about just like, it was a much more personal take. And like my stories, and it was me around, and my kids were sort of here and there. And like with this book, I was like, this is not about me. Like I'll have the personal introduction of like how we did this, but like, I didn't want my face all over it. I just wanted it to be about the food. And I was so happy that I went in that direction, because it just felt right. And I think no one wants to see my face anymore. So it was, my publisher, as part of the contract, I remember looking at it and seeing like, oh my God, 80 of the 100 recipes have to be photographed. I had never done a book like that before, but this is Clarkson Potter, and they're very famous for their cookbooks, and for a reason, they know what they're doing. And so I just thought, it's so much work to do that. Like, I don't know how I'm ever going to do that. And it was a lot of work, but it's unbelievable the difference it makes in terms of just overall, just quality of experience. You feel like, even if you don't make the recipe, it's just so fun to look at the pictures. It's just, it's a beautiful book. So, and I can say that because, you know, it was all these other people helping me. It was not just me. It was a team effort. So I'm just so, so proud of it.
Yeah, no, you absolutely should be. Yeah. And I, as someone who loves cookbooks, I always, I'm way more drawn towards the ones with full recipe or full of photos. So totally. Yeah, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, we all are.
Yeah. Great. I wanted to just ask what would you, of all the recipes in the book, which would you recommend a new cook or a new owner of your book tries first to really fall in love with the book and understand where you're coming from and your, I guess, philosophy of food?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would have to say start with the cover recipe. Because you kind of have to get on board with beans, like, and that's a tough sell. And if you get the right beans, if you get some good quality beans and you start with that recipe, then I think that would be a really exciting way to start. The chickpeas I was talking about, those crispy chickpeas, that's a hook, by the way, one of the crispy chickpea recipe. And I throw those into a Caesar salad. That's just such a no-brainer, easy meal to make on a weekday. There's a cabbage kale tofu salad with citrusy ginger dressing. That's one of those things that if you're not looking at the picture, probably doesn't sound so good. But if you're looking at the picture, which I am right now, it's like, I want this right now. It's so good. It's so healthy. It's just like shredded kale and cabbage and cucumbers and avocado and peanuts and sesame and like sort of it's a soy sauce, like, and citrusy dressings, which is just, it's so clean. And it's the kind of thing like we would eat on a Monday or a Tuesday after like having a rough indulgent weekend, you know, just like, it's really, it's so flavorful. And it's also one of those recipes, which is vegan by accident. And I loved it when that happened. I didn't mean to set out and say like, okay, I'm going to have X number of vegan recipes. It just so happened that a lot of the ones that I liked the most were. And so I thought that was a good sign. There's some good pizzas in here. There's, you know, the artichoke dip, the classic artichoke dip with cheese and spinach. I turned that into a pizza. That's definitely not a light meal, but it's gonna convince anyone, any kid, that they can go without meat for at least a day, I would say. And then, yeah, I mean, like, another thing that was important to me was to make sure that like the recipes kind of fit all your moods, like how, you know, that cabbage kale salad I was talking about before, you're not going to feel like that every day of the week, you know, you're going to want like the artichoke pizza every now and then. And so I the book is organized by those kinds of meals, like pizzas, salads, grain bowls, skillet meals. And so the idea is like, you know, for me, once I lost meat as the starting point for a meal, where when I was like, okay, I used to think, okay, I have a piece of chicken, I'll surround it with whatever. Now I had, that was gone. So now I had to kind of rewire my brain to think, okay, what am I in the mood for? I'm in the mood for a bowl. I'm in the mood for a pizza. I'm in the mood for, and then I would go from there instead. And so that's how the book is organized. So it like hopefully teaches you a way of thinking about dinner, not just the recipes themselves. Those would be all good places to start. There's so many things in this book that have become just like, I cook from it myself all the time. And especially my kids are now home from college and they've just, for all the meals they're requesting are from here. So it feels good. It feels like we did it right.
Yeah, well, that's definitely a good sign. I will say that of the recipes that I've tried so far, my favorite are the miso roasted sweet potatoes, which is super simple and so good. They're the Japanese sweet potatoes, which are just such a special vegetable when you can find it.
You can find them, because the regular sweet potatoes are so sweet and I don't mind them, but my family thinks they're just too much. And so when I can find those Japanese sweet potatoes, it's so, with the miso too, it's so easy. And that's the kind of thing that you can like build a meal around. It's just so, it tastes so like exciting and special.
Absolutely. Yeah. Anything with miso in my book is great.
100% agree.
Well, great. Thanks, Jenny. That was all I had for today. So thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an honor to talk to you.